Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire.
Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. Today on Ring of Fire, we'll be revisiting some of the very best interviews from more than a decade of being on the air. We'll hear from Howard Zinn. We'll hear from Chalmers Johnson, Daniel Ellsberg, and several other huge newsmakers and some of the most brilliant progressive minds of our time. Let's get things started with a conversation we had with Tom Hartman on his film, The Last Hours of Humanity, where he warned us about the looming dangers of global climate change.
I'm joined now by radio and TV host Tom Hartman, who recently put together a short documentary on the threats being posed by climate change. So, Tom, tell us about the video series. Last Hours is the first of a series of short films. Tell us about what the entire series hopes to achieve.
Well, we hope to change the conversation around climate change and, you know, get people engaged and enthusiastic and active, frankly. The first in the series talks about a really important issue, and that is the possible extinction of most of all life on Earth, which would, of course, include humans. This has happened five times in the Earth's deep geologic history, and every time it was driven by climate change. And but, you know, I can get into more depth on that. In fact, we will in a minute. But, you know, how this time is different from and similar to those times. But this is a conversation that the geologists have been having. And this is what got me all excited about making these videos is I've been a member of AAAS, you know, the big science organization for years and years. And I get science. And I've been reading these geologic journals or these studies published in science that are cross-published in geology journals that are talking about parallels between the current era and things like the Permian mass extinction. And none of it has been making its way into the popular media. It's not been making its way pretty much beyond geology. And even climatologists are largely unaware of the mechanism by which the five great extinctions on planet Earth happened. So our first video was to explain that.
Well, tell us what is the Permian mass extinction, and tell us what those five great extinctions, what were they and what caused them?
Right. Well, a mass extinction is defined as a time when more than half of all life on Earth vanishes and within a relatively short geologic period of time, which is typically, you know, 80 to 100,000 years. And there have been five times in the history of the Earth, in the 5 billion year history of the Earth, and the roughly 1 billion year history of life on Earth, there have been five times where more than half of all life got wiped out. The one that's the most famous is what's called the KT extinction, the one where the dinosaurs vanished. That was 65 million years ago. But that was only, you know, we only lost about 65-70% of species with that extinction. A lot of stuff survived that became ultimately us. But the Permian mass extinction was the worst of the five. This was 250 million years ago. And in the Permian mass extinction, depending on whose numbers you're using and looking at, somewhere between 95 and 97% of all life on Earth vanished, both in the oceans and on land. It was the mother of all extinctions.
And what drove those extinctions?
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, Sam. What we find is that in each case, the extinctions were caused by the crust of the Earth being either penetrated or cracking open, and in the process releasing enough greenhouse gases to produce radical greenhouse gas-driven global warming, which rendered the planet inhospitable for the currently existing species. So most of them died off, and the few that could adapt to the new temperature normals became the next reboot. You know, the dinosaurs died off, and the mammals came along because mammals were warm-blooded and they could deal with the new temperatures post KT. So up until the 1960s, really nobody knew what any of these extinctions were caused. Any of them. There was this theory that they had all been caused by meteorites hitting the Earth and puncturing the Earth's crust, and then that would, you know, let enough of these gases escape from the Earth that it would produce this global warming that would kill things off. They nailed down the meteorite theory for the KT extinction, the 165 million years ago. It was apparently a meteorite that hit the Earth around near where Cancun is, where that basically made the Gulf of Mexico. And that punched a big enough hole in the Earth that enough carbon containing and other greenhouse gases were released. But it wasn't really until around 2000, 2002 that they nailed down what caused the Permian, the worst of all of them. And they had always assumed it was a meteorite. It turns out it wasn't. It happened during a time when the Earth had only one continent on it. And as that continent started moving and splitting into two and all these other processes, but this actually preceded that. It kind of presaged that. There was this huge volcanic eruption that went on for thousands of years in an area that we now call Siberia. The region is called the Siberian Traps. And over a period of time, this volcanic eruption produced enough greenhouse gases that it raised the temperature of the Earth ultimately, you know, when the whole thing was all done, by probably somewhere between 20 and 30 degrees Celsius, which just, you know, wiped out everything.
Now, when we talk about the inability of species to adapt, is it simply a function of a change in temperature, or is it a function of what the change in temperature does to the access to things like food and et cetera?
It's very much the latter. Biosystems, ecosystems change, and plants, animals, and sometimes the microorganisms that support them. For example, trees exist because there's fungi on their roots and bacteria on their roots that transport nutrients into them. And in some cases, climate change, it makes those bacteria and fungi not work as well. And so the trees can't transport the nutrients that they need. And you end up with fragile trees that are vulnerable to things like rust and, you know, beetles and funguses and things. So that's the process. The two really important points that we try to make in this first movie are, number one, there are tipping points. And when you hit those tipping points into a mass extinction, you typically don't know that you've passed the tipping point until you're already past it. And number two, that the major tipping point is the release of methane gas that is frozen in ice slurries around the coasts of the continents and in the Arctic region and in the Arctic permafrost. And number three, really, if you think of the first five extinctions, four of them were caused by massive volcanic activity. One was caused by a meteorite punching a hole that was functionally the same thing as massive volcanic activity. In each case, the core, the crust of the Earth was breached. What we have been doing for 150 years now is the same thing. We have been breaching the crust of the Earth. We've been drilling holes into the Earth. Only instead of doing it like with a big thick hammer that just goes whap, you know, with the meteorite, for example, hitting Cancun or the Siberian Traps going off for 1,000 years, instead of doing that in that blunt force way where, you know, you're hitting some areas that are carbon rich and some areas that are carbon poor and you get all kinds of other stuff going on, you know, volcanic rock and stuff. Instead of doing that, what we've been doing is searching the planet for the carbon rich areas and then drilling specifically into them or mining specifically into them, extracting the carbon-containing compounds, natural gas, coal, and oil, and then burning those and throwing the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So we have altered the planet's atmosphere by punching holes in the crust and pulling out these ancient stores of carbon the same way, functionally, I mean, the mechanism has been different, but the end result could be the same as in the these previous five mass extinctions. And there's we have burned 350 billion tons of carbon. We have burned it and thrown it into the atmosphere since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, roughly 1850. 350 billion tons. And that has produced a 1 degree temperature increase, which means that there's another degree that's pretty much unstoppable. There's always, whatever you've done, there's that much in the pipeline before it exhausts itself. So that 350 billion tons is producing a 2 degree Celsius temperature increase, or ultimately will. Just in the Arctic, there's somewhere between 1 and 2 trillion tons of carbon in the form of methane, largely, in the Arctic permafrost and in these methane hydrate, these methane snow cone slushes just under the ice on the surface of the shallow, relatively shallow surface of the Arctic Ocean. And
that's basically functioning like a loaded gun.
Right.
And we got to take a break. But when we come back, let's talk about the rate of methane gas release and greenhouse gases in the last five great extinctions and where we are relative to that it's a little clinical to call it a process, but that's what we're involved in. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with Tom Hartman when we return. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Tom Hartman about his new short documentary, The Last Hours of Humanity, which talks about the disastrous consequences of global climate change that humanity is currently facing and causing. So, Tom, when we broke, we were talking about the enormous potential that sits underneath the ice caps and the ice slurries, particularly in the poles of our planet, and how the release of those gases are going to impact us. Before we talk about that impact, let's just go back, because you had mentioned that the series of films that are going to be released, the specific one that is released first, shows that we've had five great extinctions in the past. Where are we? And you describe those great extinctions as taking place over the course of tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. Where are we in the process of hitting those tipping points that you mentioned?
Well, this is the big problem, Sam. Nobody knows. And that's why we made this movie Last Hours and put it up at lasthours.org. What we do know is that there's more carbon dioxide in the air than in the entire history of the human race. What we do know is that there's between 1 and 2 trillion tons of carbon frozen in the form of frozen methane in the Arctic. And the Arctic is warming 2 to 3 times faster than the equatorial and temperate regions. What we do know is that there's somewhere between 4 and 12 trillion tons of carbon along the continental shelves of the Earth. And that 90%, the latest IPCC report, 90% of global warming is being absorbed by our oceans. Now, because that methane itself freezes at like 300 degrees below zero, this is not frozen methane. What it is it's frozen ice. The methane forms when plant matter decays and falls to the bottom of the ocean. It starts to rot, and as it rots, it releases methane gas, natural gas. But if it's at a point where the water is colder than 32 degrees, but is still kept liquid because it's under great pressure, because it's deep enough in the ocean, then that methane will cause the water around it to form an ice crystal that wouldn't normally form. And in the center of that ice crystal is a bubble of methane. And you get enough of this and you get, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of tons of this stuff. It's like giant pools of this stuff along all along the surface, all along the coasts of all the continents. And because it's frozen water, not frozen methane, you know, water changes from a solid state to a liquid state with about a 1 degree temperature differential. You know, you go from 31 to 32 degrees and you go from ice to water, or 32 to 33, and depending on the pressure. And in this case, it might be 30 to 31, or it might be 29 to 30, you know, depending on how deep the methane clathrates, hydrates are. But it's just a 1 degree. It might be a 2 degree. It depends on how deep it is, but it's not much. It doesn't take much. The Permian, and the BBC did a brilliant documentary on this. You can watch the whole thing. It's an hour long. They did it back in 2003. It's called The Day the Earth Nearly Died, and you can find it on YouTube really easily if you just plug that, The Day the Earth Nearly Died, in. And what they found was, you know, okay, here's this 80,000-year period of the Permian mass extinction, but there was this sudden pulse about 40,000 years into it where, you know, after these Siberian traps have been erupting and erupting and erupting, where suddenly there was so much carbon in the rock layer, and it coincided with a time when all the fossils vanished. It was like the Earth died, and there was all this carbon-12. And there was more carbon that could be accounted for by the death of all the plants and animals on Earth and in the sea. So where did it come from? And this was first published in 1998, you know, asking, where the heck did this carbon come from? And it wasn't until around 2000 that a guy named Jerry Dickens published a paper saying, well, it looks like the methane frozen under the seas get melted and bubbled up through the water and into the air. And methane is 70 times roughly more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And when it does decay, it decays to carbon dioxide. And so that methane, that pulse of methane, produced an enormous and sudden surge of global warming. So, you know, while the Permian took thousands of years, all of the mass, the KT was faster because it was initiated by an asteroid, but the Permian and the other three all apparently took thousands of years. Climatologist Michael Mann says on our video, and any geologist will tell you this, the rate at which we're pumping carbon into the atmosphere right now, we humans, is faster than has happened in any of the previous mass extinctions, with the possible exception of the KT with the meteorite, but it's faster than the other four. So we don't know when we're going to hit that tipping point, but what we do know is if we pass that tipping point, we probably won't know it for a generation or two, but within 100 or 200 years, we will no longer be here. So I encourage people to get over to lasthours.org and check it out.
Thanks so much, Tom. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks for highlighting this, Sam. I really appreciate it.
Tom Hartman is the host of the Tom Hartman Program in The Big Picture. You can watch his new film, The Last Hours of Humanity, online at lasthours.org.
Coming up on Ring of Fire, Daniel Ellsberg will be joining us to talk about America's surveillance state. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and you're listening to Ring of Fire.
Hey, today's show was made possible in part by BetterHelp. BetterHelp is an online service. It gives you unlimited access to your own fully licensed therapist by way of phone, video, and chat. And they're giving Ring of Fire listeners 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/ROF radio. That's betterhelp.com/ROF radio. Look, this is how it works. You get paired up, and you'll be communicating with your therapist within 24 hours of signing up. You don't have to go into an office. You can do it from your home or wherever. If you're on the go, it doesn't matter. You can log into your account anytime and send messages to your therapist. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. You can schedule your live meetings at any time that fit your schedule. And if you don't think your therapist is working out, if it's not a great match, you can switch to someone new at any time for no extra charge. It's more affordable than traditional in-person therapy. Financial aid is available, and you'll get 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/ROF radio. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ROF radio.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. President Obama recently gave a speech where he addressed the issue of domestic surveillance and the revelations that came forward last summer from whistleblower Edward Snowden. The president dodged the issue of whether or not these activities would continue indefinitely, and Americans are left to wonder just how deep the surveillance on American citizens go and how much a threat this is to our beloved constitutional guarantees in the Bill of Rights. Joining me now to talk about this is Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. military analyst. Let me ask you about what's happening today. Is, in your opinion, is Edward Snowden, I mean, you are a hero to our generation. You changed, you know, you ended the Vietnam War. Without you, it would not have ended when it did. You exposed, you know, all of this history of government lies. You changed the way people felt about their government. They, you know, we grew up in a world where we couldn't believe that the United States government would lie to us. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, you show that this terrible web of history of lies that and just the background for people who don't know about this, McNamara commissioned a report. McNamara, who was always anti-war, although he escalated it, McNamara commissioned the Pentagon and I think the Rand Corporation to do a history of the war, of how we had gotten into it, to make sure it could never happen again. And you were part of the team. You had worked for Henry Kissinger. You were this brilliant Harvard kid who had been to Vietnam, who had been in the Marines, was a war hero, and came back and from Vietnam and was a war hawk at one point, and now you were looking at it and saying this is not what it was supposed to be. But you were part of that group that went through tens of thousands of documents and traced how we had gotten into it. One of those copies was an Rand Corporation safe. You got pissed off one night because the Nixon administration had dropped a lawsuit against a group of special forces and CIA team who had murdered a South Vietnamese informant and dumped his body in the South China Sea. And you said, that's it for me. I'm going to give this to the New York Times. And you Xerox this doc, I don't know, 28 volumes or whatever it was, and gave it to the New York Times. And that was the end. And so you really changed history, and you're a hero. Do you consider Edward Snowden, or let's even broaden it, Julian Assange, to be doing the same thing you were doing, or is there a difference?
There are very great similarities, and of course there are differences. The differences don't change my opinion at all that Edward Snowden and before him Chelsea Manning, and in a different role, Julian Assange, he was a publisher, sort of in the role of the New York Times relative to the Pentagon Papers. He was not the source, but he was the medium for this, still at considerable risk to himself. They are personal heroes of mine. I think they're Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden are great Americans. Julian Assange is not American, which means he's not eligible to be a traitor, but he was eligible to be called a traitor by everyone, just as interestingly, Snowden is being called a traitor by the Australian Prime Minister. Actually, that's Assange's home base, Australia. And for some reason, and the Foreign Minister are pronouncing on Edward Snowden as a traitor, which is ridiculous. He's no more a traitor than I am, and I'm not. Definitely. And in the account you gave of this, which is right in general outlines, but incorrect in certain things. For example, I worked for Henry Kissinger after the Pentagon Papers, after I'd worked on the Pentagon Papers in the Nixon administration. And I was certainly not a war hero. I was a civilian in Vietnam, and I did use my Marine training from some years earlier as a rifle platoon leader and a rifle company commander. I used that experience to walk with troops without endangering them in combat and did see a fair amount of combat. So I saw the war close up in Vietnam, and it had a big influence on me. And I did work on the Pentagon Papers. Another little correction here. The Pentagon Papers, you said, were in a safe at Rand. They were in my safe. Very few people had top secret safes in their office. at RAND. They had to go to the top secret control office for that. They had only secret files. I was one of the few with a top secret safe, and that was in part because I had been authorized to study the Pentagon Papers. I was one of, actually the only researcher, along with the president of the company, who had access to the papers at that time. Now, that's a very close analogy to Snowden, because what he gave was material that he had access to, and in effect authorized access, because, as he said, for contractors at Booz Allen working for the NSA, once you were in and you had the clearances, which he had, and the authorized access to the systems, there were no rules. There was very little oversight from then on. At that point, he was free. He said anyone in his position could have simply walked out that door for any reason with all that information, and could have sold it for a very great price to various foreign powers, which, again, any more than Chelsea Manning, he did not do. He gave it to the American people without any recompense, and at risk of his life from then on. And I'll tell you really why, as I just heard him say in an interview with German television. I was watching it last night, which I recommend to people, by the way. Just look up Snowden and German television on Google News, and you'll find it. And he said, "I will never be fully out of danger." And he says, "unless these systems totally change," which is, frankly, very far off. And I think that's true for the same reason that President Nixon actually brought a dozen Cuban CIA assets from the Bay of Pigs to incapacitate me on the steps of the Capitol on May 3rd, 1972, a year into my trial and a year away from the ending of my trial. So in the midst of that, he brought people up to incapacitate me, and that had really nothing to do with what I had already revealed.
And the reason that was Howard Hunt. That was Howard.
What he hasn't revealed, they're afraid of him, and as they were afraid of me, Nixon was afraid of me because of what they knew I knew that had not yet been revealed, and they needed to shut that up. It wasn't enough to put me on trial. It will never be enough for them to put Snowden on trial and let him out on bail. If he came back to this country, I do not believe at all that he would be given a moment's freedom. He would be incarcerated in isolation like Chelsea Manning from the moment he arrived, the moment he was captured, where they kidnapped him, and he'd never get out and could very well simply be killed, either kept in isolation or killed, because, first of all, there's a lot that hasn't come out yet that he has given to the newspapers, but beyond that, he's made it clear that he chose what he gave to the newspapers and what he thought the public needed to know, which should be public, and he has held back and did not give to the newspapers or copy or bring with him a tremendous amount of material that he felt would not serve a public interest to be put out and was deservedly secret. But they would never trust him on that, not to decide to put some of that on under some circumstances, or put out stuff that should be out but they didn't want out and that hasn't yet come out. He'll never be safe from that. Russia is probably as safe a place as he can find, because it's one of the few countries, with all its shortcomings still, that is willing to stand up to the U.S. on this and not simply hand him over. And other countries that could agree with him politically were not willing to give him asylum. He applied to practically every country in Europe.
Dan, can you stay with us and talk a little more after the break?
Sure.
We'll be right back with more from Daniel Ellsberg. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and you're listening to Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Right now, I'm talking with former military analyst turned activist Dan Ellsberg about the United States domestic spying programs. Let me ask you two more questions because you've been very generous with your time. One is this kind of cognitive dissonance that allows us to do the drone strikes and the invasions of Iraq, et cetera. And it's something that my father was deeply concerned about. He talked about the toll on civilians in Vietnam, which we now know was somewhere around 7 million people died in that war. And over the 20 years that we were there and with the French.
30 years.
Yeah, but today, you know, I give this analogy. If there's now 37 nations that have drones, right, including Canada, if there were some Quebec independent group had committed a crime in Canada and then fled to the United States to Brooklyn, for example, and the Canadian military and security police knew that they were in an apartment in Brooklyn and sent a drone strike down and killed that apartment and killed, you know, a couple of other people in the building. You know, how would we feel about that? And why, if we feel that that's wrong, then how can we be doing that to people in Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and the Sudan and all these other countries? Because we consider ourselves a humane nation. And how do we allow ourselves to, you know, how do we rationalize murdering civilians with nations we aren't even at war with, but murdering civilians?
You said that as eloquently and as passionately as your father would have if he were alive, and I can just hear him denouncing this right now. Of course, the questions really answer themselves once you've raised them in that way. The incident you hypothesize there, and they're sending drones over to kill people over here, the country would be, I think, at first absolutely stunned, as well as shocked, with outrage and horror at the very idea of...
And then a week later, Canada would be the 51st state, right? I mean, we would invade them. We would consider an act of war.
Right. And the, so why don't they do that? Because we are so strong, so we're safe in doing this, right? Well, actually, making ourselves the most hated nation in the world in Pakistan, a country, an unstable country with nuclear weapons, and a fanatical Islamic fundamentalist who law in the international, the ISI, the intelligence apparatus there, that wants to get control of those nuclear weapons and share them or use them. I can't imagine any policy more dangerous than what President Obama, far more than Bush, has actually pursued in killing all kinds of people, both killing people we consider terrorists and people who by any standards are children, babies, old women, civilians, along with them. And by the way, not just a couple when we kill a terrorist. I think the ratio of civilians get killed is something like 17 to 1 compared to people we claim to be terrorists without knowing that. They are experiencing that in that country. Are they just somehow peculiar for hating the country that does this to them? You're raising the question, how would we feel? Well, that isn't too hard to answer. And I'm saying that's dangerous. It's dangerous to be earning hatred like that, and not only in Pakistan, but you know, in many other countries in the world. I am very happy. I have very great criticisms of President Obama, as you've heard. Although I supported him for election in both the last elections because I thought that the Republican opponent would be even worse, and I still think that. And the confirmation of that is, we're not bombing Syria today, and we're not following the siren call to involve ourselves in that very tragic and horrible situation in Syria, and we're not bombing Iran. And I believe that the Republican opponents would be bombing Iran. They wouldn't necessarily be worse on many of the things we've been discussing, the civil liberties aspect and the surveillance. They might be about the same. I think when it comes to being at war in Syria and Iran, we would be. So where credit is due, I credit Obama with responding to public pressure on that. But what is he responding to? During a congressional recess, constituents amazed their representatives, according to all the news stories, by buttonholing them in malls and restaurants and wherever they found them and saying, no war in Syria. We don't want war with Syria. Now, when I read that, I thought, like the Congress people, where did that come from? What's this? They didn't object to Libya or what got into them. I don't know fully the answer to that. I think Snowden played a role, by the way, in this kind of, we've had enough. This is it. You know, no more of this. Or as Gorbachev said to his wife, Raisa, when he was deciding whether to take the job of general secretary, we can't go on like this. And I'm waiting for some leaders to say that. We can't go on like this.
I have one last question for you, which is the corrosive impact of excessive corporate power on American democracy and American values. And you know, you saw as far back as the Vietnam War that in many ways our military and intelligence apparatus became kind of a servant of the mercantile interests of U.S. corporations. Has that trend amplified over time, and how much of a problem do you think it is to our democracy?
Well, you know, at the time when I was in the government, and I was, you say military, but I was an official, special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and then a Forward Service Officer Reserve One, highest ranking in the embassy in Saigon. And I have to say that I was, and earlier at the RAND Corporation as a consultant, I wasn't really conscious at that time of corporate influence of the kind that Eisenhower had referred to, the military-industrial complex. I didn't see that. Even when I thought our policy was mistaken, as in Vietnam, I didn't see it as a result of corporate influence. And to this day, that's a complex question on Vietnam. What were the influences on that? But on Iraq, that's not so hard to see. The oil industry there was crucial. To this day, we have not learned the makeup, the membership of Vice President Cheney's task force on energy, which was looking at the invasion of Iraq and parceling out the oil fields there to various corporations. He refused to make public who he had consulted with. And I would presume that Obama could tell us that, could find that out and put it out, but he's honoring that secret somehow. So we have a corporate influence there that is relatively open. And that's true in Iran, too, really, among other things. There are various influences, but the oil of Iran has always been a target. But on the surveillance matter, it's really Snowden, I think, who's done a lot to alert us to what amounts to a corporate government collaboration. Makes them almost the same unit, which Mussolini called corporatism or fascism, where there's really very little distinction between certain corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, for which Snowden worked as a contractor, and the NSA or the telephone companies.
Daniel Ellsberg is a former U.S. military analyst, best known for releasing the Pentagon Papers, which detailed the decision-making process that led America into Vietnam War. Thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Thank you for having me. Great opportunity.
Just ahead on Ring of Fire, we'll hear an interview from the great Chalmers Johnson, where he'll tell us why America's obsession with empire building is going to be a disaster for this country. I'm Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire.
I fell into a ring of fire. Went down, down,
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. Over the years at Ring of Fire, we've had the privilege of speaking to some of the greatest political minds in the last century. One of the greats we had the pleasure of speaking with several times was the late Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn was on the front line of progressive movements for nearly 60 years before he passed away. And he often used examples of our own American history to tell us how we can move forward. His most famous work, A People's History of the United States, has sold millions of copies since its release and inspired generation after generation of young activists to take a stand. And in his call to action, Zinn warned us that if we continue to sit idly by, we'll all fall victim to the threat of American imperialism. So let's revisit one of the earliest conversations with Mr. Zinn, and you'll see that his wisdom and advice are still as accurate today as they were several years ago. So, Mr. Zinn, 1980, A People's History of the United States. Since then, it's sold almost 2 million copies. And I think what people remember about that book, and when they read it the first time, it was a people's history that really was without the heroes. It was out without the myths. It was without that blind nationalism that we've seen so often with history books. And I think it really grabbed everybody's interest because of that. So now you have a People's History of American Empire narrated almost a cartoon form. Right. Tell me why you decided to do that.
Well, actually, I didn't decide to do that.
It was somebody demanded it, huh?
It just came out of the heavens. No, Mike Konopacki, the cartoonist,
right?
The artist, and Paul Bueller, the historian, it was really their idea. And they approached me and they said, hey, how about a cartoon history based on your book, A People's History of the United States? I said, okay, because I say okay to most things. and so they went ahead and basically, you know, they did it with consulting with me. And they, Mike Konopacki is a wonderful really artist, and the cartoons in this book are, you know, quite amazing. And Paul Bueller did a lot of research, and they said, well, you know, we're going to concentrate on that part of your book that deals with American foreign policy, American expansion. Well, so we're going to use some material from your memoir, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, from some of your other writings. We're also going to, you know, make it personal. We're going to have you as a character. And so he draws me.
Yes. Great job, by the way. I mean,
you think so?
Let me just tell you, it is a wonderful book. It honestly is. It is such a great idea. I'm so glad they talked you into it. So the book starts out, it opens with 9/11, and then it jumps back, and it really kind of explores the cycles of U.S. expansionism all the way from Wounded Knee to Iraq.
Right.
And it stops along the way with World War I, Central America, Vietnam. But you know, the themes that I think it captures are the themes that were initially captured in 1980 with The People's History of the United States. And you start off really by painting the picture of how dangerous it is for the American public, or really any nationality, to rely too much on this hero worship and on saviors, that we're always looking for that savior. Talk about that a little bit. Let's begin the discussion there.
Yeah. Yeah, saviors. It's very interesting because we consider ourselves a democratic country, and we think of totalitarian countries and dictatorships as places where, oh, there's some big father figure, you know, whether it's Stalin or you know, somebody in this totalitarian country that, you know, you defer to. And here we are, a democratic country, and yet we have grown up in a culture in which we are taught to revere the founding fathers, and we're taught to revere the military heroes, and our history is told through the presidents, you know, the age of Jackson, the age of Lincoln, the age of Roosevelt, you know, it's ironic. In a democracy, you're not supposed to revere and have too much respect for the people who are running the country. You're supposed to be active, engaged, critical citizens. So in people's history, and again in this People's History of American Empire, well, there are heroes, but they're not the usual heroes. That is, you don't find Theodore Roosevelt, the warmonger, as a hero. You don't find Theodore Roosevelt, the man who thinks, you know, war is the highest quality that a human being can have.
It's what we learned in high school, right?
Yeah, we have Mark Twain as a hero because Mark Twain spoke out against Theodore Roosevelt and denounced him because Roosevelt had praised a military massacre in the Philippines. So, yeah, we have heroes, but they're very different, and they represent what people need, and they don't represent the establishment.
Let's take a quick break, but we'll get back to our discussion with the late Howard Zinn when we return. If you want even more Ring of Fire, then you can visit us online at ringoffireradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back. Counting all different ideas drifting away. Past and present, that don't matter, not a future sorted out. Watch your move. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Mike Papantonio. Right now we're listening to a conversation that we had with the late Howard Zinn from the early days of Ring of Fire, and his words are as important today, if not more important, than they were when he spoke those words several years ago. Howard, you weave the story very, very well about how the hero and the savior is just kind of one of those controlling mechanisms that controls the population when against rebellion. I mean, you know, if you think about it, rebellion has been pretty well suppressed by the American elite for a long time. How do you think 1% of the nation owning about a third of the wealth in the country, how is it that they've been able to say, well, you know, that's a good deal for everybody, and it works for everybody? How have they been able to hold back rebellion in a situation like that?
Yeah, that question has been asked many times. You know, what is special about the United States that we've only had one revolution way back? And I guess there are several answers to that. One is that because we have a semblance of democracy, that's because we have a semblance of representative government. You know, we have all the right institutions, people vote, and on paper you have checks and balances, and, you know, on paper the president can be thwarted by Congress or ruled out of order by the Supreme Court. So, you know, we have all the paper requisites of a democracy, even though we don't have real democracy because these institutions don't really work for the people. But the paper democracy is good enough so that that is persuasive enough. So the people growing up and going to school and saying, oh, looking on a blackboard and saying, look, we have checks and balances. So people are fooled into believing we have democracy and that therefore whatever happens, you know, happens in a democratic way. I mean, that's one reason why we have not had rebellion, because we have political institutions that entice people into thinking they don't need a rebellion. I think the other answer is that this country is wealthy enough so that it can dispense enough goodies to part of the population so that you don't have, you know, 80% angry poor people. You know, you have 30% poor people, and then you have another 60% who are not really poor and who are just well off enough to think that they are doing well in this system. In other words, we have a kind of a fairly contented middle class which doesn't see revolution as necessary and therefore which accepts the idea of the reality of a small elite taking most of the wealth of the country and the rest of the people sort of paying obeisance to this small elite.
Talking with Howard Zinn of People's History of American Empire, let me pick up with that very idea. It's interesting that you almost have, with this class distinction that's been, I mean, again, you have 1% of the nation owning a third of the wealth. And that leaves about 99% that really, if you think about it, it's almost as if they're pitted against each other to kind of fight for what's left.
Exactly.
Is that a stabilizing force?
Well, it has been a stabilizing force in a sense, and it doesn't make life stable for the people who are fighting one another, and many of whom are left behind, but it stabilizes the system because, as you said, it keeps people fighting against one another. It causes, you know, middle-class people to see their enemies as welfare mothers or to see their enemies as the criminals who they will put in prison and therefore take care of the problem. And you know, whites pitted against blacks because the blacks are taking our jobs, or affirmative action is benefiting them instead of us. So yes, they're pitting people against one another, and in that way maintaining control. The immigrant thing is another example. You know, you pit the native born, who themselves come from immigrants, pit them against the recent immigrants. You have them battling one another and building walls along the southern borders of California. Meanwhile, the elite is reaping in the dough.
Well, you know, there's always this illusion of unity, though, isn't there? There's this illusion of unity that really, if you think about it, it's the illusion that was created all the way back when the Founding Fathers wrote the preamble to the Constitution saying, we the people, almost pretending that we have a government that stood by everybody, for everybody, and hope that this, you know, kind of this mythological idea would be, would be something that could perpetuate itself. Do you think that illusion of unity is holding fast today?
Well, I think it's beginning to break up. You know, because the illusion of unity depends on the notion that the people in power have the same interests as the people out of power, that we're all unified, you know, in our values and our desires, and if something goes wrong, it's because somebody made a mistake. But what happens when people begin to learn the reality is they learn that the interests of the people in power are not the same as the interests of the rest of us. And when that happens, that unity begins to break up. We are now experiencing a growing notion, I think, in this country that the interests of the Bush administration and maybe even the interests of the top leaders of the Democratic Party are not the interests of the rest of the people. And there is no unified national interest, and therefore people had better look to their own interests. That those of us who are out of power had better organize ourselves as citizens and understand that the government really doesn't care about us, that the government will send our young people to war for their own benefit, and that the corporations will take advantage of everybody and make huge profits while people are getting their homes taken away from them. There's no unity of interest there, and I think more and more people are beginning to recognize that, and my hope is that enough people begin to recognize that so we have a rebellion in this country against that 1% that you speak of owning 35-40% of the wealth.
Well, we have seen rebellion in the past, but it's been minor rebellion. I mean, we've seen the blacks, the African Americans rebel, women rebel. We've seen working people that at one point were rebellious enough to stand behind their union. We've seen government intellectuals rebel when they've given out secrets that they thought would affect the safety of democracy. So we've seen rebellion, but it hasn't been. If you look at the totality of this picture, it is that illusion of unity, that kind of ability to be able to avoid class conflict, has worked extremely well. When you think of what's existed here,
well, it has worked, but there are times when it breaks down, and you were just talking about the rebellion of blacks and. And there was the rebellion of soldiers in Vietnam, the rebellion of the American population against the war, the growing rebellion now, and among soldiers, too, who are refusing to go back to Iraq. So We're talking about a dynamic process, a process that changes. If we look at the situation at any given moment of time, it looks rather bleak. If you think about it historically in perspective and see that there are times in history when bleak moments turned into victories for people. There haven't been too many of those times, but enough of those times to encourage us to persist in disobeying the orders of the corporations and of the generals and of the president. And my hope is that there will be a new citizens' movement growing up in this country, which will, you know, combine the energy of the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the labor movement and so on, and really bring about a change in the present structure. That's what we need.
Yeah, I read one time, I thought it was just so accurate in what you thought might be one factor that brings that about. You said that capitalism has really been a failure for lower class, and now it's becoming a failure for the middle class, yeah, with the threat of unemployment, the inability, yeah, to get a college education. And now that maybe is putting us in a posture where we will see radical change. Well, you still think that's possible?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful about that.
Howard Zinn, A People's History of American Empire, one of the world's great thinkers. Thank you for joining
us.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was the late Howard Zinn. For more, I encourage you to pick up a copy of The People's History of the United States. Just ahead on Ring of Fire, we'll hear an interview from the great Chalmers Johnson, where he'll tell us why America's obsession with empire building is going to be a disaster for this country. I'm Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back.
Tell me something I don't know, 'cause we've been met some times before. Make it up as we go along.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. Shortly before the 2008 election, I interviewed the late historian and author Chalmers Johnson about the dangers of American imperialism. We had just been through 8 years of George Bush's foreign policy disasters, and international affairs were playing a huge role in the 2008 elections. And there's still a lot of similarities between the election 4 years ago and the one that we'll decide in about a month. The U.S. is still involved in more fiascos in the Middle East, terrorist attacks are occurring overseas, and foreign policy issues need to be on the minds of all Americans. So let's listen to what Chalmers Johnson warned us about before his death. You know, Chalmers, out of being the author of 17 books, it's hard to choose any one that I would say is just really my favorite, but Nemesis, it's mighty good stuff.
Well, that probably would be mine, too.
Oh, really? Really?
I've been working on hardest.
Well, it's just excellent. So let me get right to the heart of it, okay?
Okay.
First of all, if you were to describe why we maybe are that empire that's on its way towards ruin, you have a list of things that I think is just extremely interesting. I want to go down the list, and why don't you fill them in as we go, okay?
All right.
You're talking about the idea that we have a government that's driving the nation to tyranny and ruin. I mean, that's the premise.
Yes.
And then you say these are the reasons. Let's go down the list. A very compelling argument that you have here.
Okay.
First of all, a nation with no outside threats that's,
yes,
permanently at war. Fill that in a little bit.
Well, it is to say our commitment, probably never formal, rather erstwhile, but our commitment to imperialism and militarism puts us into the fix of all empires since that of the Roman Republic. We face one of the greatest dilemmas of any nation in history, namely a domestic democracy and a foreign empire. History tells us you can have one, you can have the other, but you can't have both.
Okay, the most secretive, intrusive, and repressive government in our history, and a president who you describe as a serial liar that all of our listeners would agree with. Fill that in a little bit.
I think there's just no question that it is still hard to understand, since we presume that George Bush is an American and was educated in American schools, and that he went to Yale University and Harvard Law School and a few other such things. He doesn't seem to have ever heard the least obvious elements in the Constitution, the separation of powers, the fact that they are our most important defense against tyranny and dictatorship, that this is a work of genius, above all by James Madison, but by many others, and that he has systematically subverted it with ideas that there isn't a constitutional scholar in the country who would agree with the possible exception of an apparently insane lawyer sitting at the University of California, Berkeley's law school, right. Namely James Yeo.
Right. But this is a president that would suggest that he's smarter than the framers, so we know where that goes. Okay,
yes.
The unprecedented wealth disparity that takes place where you have a corporate power that has really, in a sense, created that disparity. And you in your book, you just, again, every one of these points, you do such a great job rounding them out.
Well, thank you.
But you talk about Brandeis, and he says this. We all know Supreme Court Justice Brandeis said
right.
that we can either have democracy in this country or we can have a great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. How does – fill that in as far as your theory that we are driving ourselves towards ruin.
Well, it's a matter of – just open the newspaper. I mean, the crises are on us every day. We're the one of the few advanced democracies on Earth that doesn't provide health care for all the population. Any number of people, including personal friends of mine, live without health insurance. They simply decided that it doesn't fit into their budget anymore. We have a fuel crisis that's driving our economy into potential bankruptcy. Standing behind all of this is not to say we don't have the money. We do have the money, but we're wasting it in the most profligate possible way on foreign wars, on military equipment that we don't need, and that in fact we don't even think works. We don't care whether it works or not. Most of this is being spent as a jobs program, that the military-industrial complex has become an intrinsic part of our economy these days.
Well, I want to get to that, and I want to talk about that, but I want to stop with this one. You talk about, in order, as we drive ourselves towards this abysmal end,
yes.
that you really do equate to, you equate to other civilizations, Rome, the Greeks,
yes.
the Soviet Union, Japan. I mean, I could go on with that, but
Britain,
for example.
One,
yeah, but one thing that you say is you say that if you look at all of those failures, that one thing that you had was a de facto one-party state with two wings and a mm-hmm. president claiming almost exclusive executive power where they ignore the rule of law. You saw that playing itself out in other empires that have
yes.
failed.
No question. Now, granted, there's nothing deterministic about this. I mean, that you can wake up and do the right thing. The example I use in my book, Nemesis, is the British Empire at the end of World War II. It didn't do it well. It did it in an extremely sloppy manner. There were many atavistic throwbacks later. But the British understood that you couldn't continue to use Nazi methods in holding together the British Empire.
To some extent, Chalmers, they saved themselves, didn't they?
They did, exactly. I mean, I agree there with Hannah Arendt in her comments in The Origins of Totalitarianism mm-hmm. that this is one of the great achievements of Britain and even of Europe, that they recognized they had to choose. You either were going to keep India and keep it docile and servile under military power, the recognition that imperialism is a pure form of tyranny.
Okay, so
never rules by consent.
So also in this list, as we take ourselves to this thing that should be a wake-up call to anybody, by the way, for somebody to think that they really understand where we are in the world today and not have read your book, Nemesis, I think is a huge mistake.
Well,
I hope so. It really is such a great roadmap. But one of those things in your roadmap, you say that when we look at empires that have taken themselves to this abysmal end, there's always been this absence of checks and balances and separation of powers.
Or exactly.
You've had this reckless, no restraint kind of boy emperor messianic message that flows from leadership.
It's really hard to believe that George Bush didn't want advice on what he was doing. that he didn't care to pay attention to it, that he didn't, I don't mean that he even listens to his enemies, he didn't listen to his friends. I mean, Brent Scowcroft was telling him some time ago, as and the former Secretary of State Baker, that you're heading over the cliff.
Well, one thing you add in there in your list, and there's so many things that are just, I mean, they're just almost completely on point. It's almost like Britt's analysis of fascism. You know, he just lays it out point by point and says, here's what's happening. But one thing that you add here is you say the dominant corporate-controlled media is something that will take you to that abysmal end where you have the glorifying, almost just propaganda, the glorifying of imperial wars.
Well, let's make ourselves absolutely clear on this. The First Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees freedom of the press, was not written to protect People magazine. It was... what the people who wrote that, what they had, they didn't give a damn about anything like People magazine or any other sort of schlocky popular literature. The idea was to empower the press to penetrate the greatest defense of a state bureaucracy, which is secrecy. But the purpose of the free press is to try and get behind the facade of government, the lying that has become now almost second nature to any high-ranking military officer. When asked anything about what he does, he simply lies, to get behind it and publicize it. Instead, over time, as a result of propaganda, of money, of the nature of recruitment into the press, of elite universities in America, the press has become the handmaiden of power. And it, the cost of that is that it no longer performs the function of penetrating secrecy. It's the same way, in my opinion, the greatest crime of the military-industrial complex was to totally corrupt Congress.
Well, but with the media, we can both agree the fourth estate is dead and dying. And
well, it's certainly not doing its job.
Okay, you add to your list a secret intelligence establishment, and you describe it, I think, very appropriately. Near limitless funding, operating without oversight. I mean, anybody that understands what's happening clearly sees that happening, Dave. Fill that in for us a little bit.
Well, it is to say the Central Intelligence Agency, which I know something about. I was a consultant for the Office of National Estimates in the late 60s and early 70s there. The Central Intelligence Agency has operated, well, until the Church Committee following Watergate, without any form of oversight at all. It is the personal handmaiden of the president. One of the most important things the director of Central Intelligence does is on the day after a new president is inaugurated, go to him and tell him the things he can do. He can have anybody on earth he wants assassinated. He can overturn foreign governments. He can subvert foreign economies. He can do any number of things, and it will all be arranged in such a way that he can deny having done anything about it. Well, no president since Harry Truman has ever failed to use his power.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll return to our interview with the late Chalmers Johnson when we come back. I'm Mike Papantonio. You're listening to Ring of Fire. We'll be right back. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. Before the break, we were listening to an interview with the late Chalmers Johnson that took place in 2008. Let's get back to that and listen to the warnings that Johnson gave us about the dangers of American imperialism even back then. Chalmers, you describe yourself as a former spear carrier for the empire, and it's just such a rich, interesting background. I mean, that's why this book, Nemesis, speaks with such authority. When did you have the notion that maybe an omnipotent military-industrial complex that Dwight D. Eisenhower described for us, that maybe he was right, that is one of the things that moves a great empire towards its demise?
I should have had that idea much earlier, but I'm sorry to say I'm a typical American who didn't listen to Eisenhower at the time. Now we look back on
it. Is he right?
Yes, he's simply prescient. The moment of realization that there was something terribly wrong here was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the thing that struck me most of all was how instantaneously our government, from top to bottom, moved at once to find a replacement enemy. China, terrorism, drug lords, instability even, anything would do to keep the military-industrial complex functioning. Our propaganda that we simply couldn't do without it, that threats were appearing everywhere we turned. This led me to start saying we have to think again about whether the Cold War was the main substance or of the past 40 years, or whether it could have been reduced, in fact, to the growth of the empire and its demands. I believe that that is the case today, that the Cold War was very largely rigged for the entire period after the Cuban Missile Crisis, certainly in the 1980s.
For the purpose of empire expansion?
Or? Exactly. And we played games with the Soviet Union, and they played them right back with us. Both of us were profiting from the idea that we faced an implacable foe. And particularly during the 1980s, when we were vastly overestimating the threat from the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan simply lived off of that. But then so did innumerable private organizations.
So in that theory, that one of the in the checklist of things that we need to be cognizant of as we watch our empire, move closer and closer to that point of no return.
Yes.
One of them being the omnipotent military-industrial complex. It wasn't just Dwight Eisenhower that said. George Washington actually said in his farewell address, 1796, I think you pointed.
We have to remember that we used to read Washington's farewell address at the opening of every session of Congress.
He said an overgrown military establishment under our form of government is a threat to liberty.
He said the greatest threat to liberty, and particularly to Republican liberty, is standing armies.
Yeah.
Now, he wasn't, that is, after all, this is the general who led our country to victory against the world's greatest empire in the Revolutionary War. He wasn't opposed to having a military, but he was opposed to having a permanent standing military, which draws power to Washington, which draws vested interest to the military as a way of life, which, as he said, undercuts the separation of powers and lodges power in the executive branch. That we see it today simply every time we open the newspaper.
But let me ask you this. Ongoing with your list, this checklist that we should all be cognizant of, we all should all say, look, history tells us a lot of things if we'll look at the roadmap. And this is a roadmap. Nemesis is really a wonderful roadmap. But you add in that list that one thing we need to be conscious of is when we have a weak, almost servile Congress that accedes to a dominant, almost imperial presidency.
That was the key institution in the minds of the founders.
Right.
It was the organization that would provide oversight. That's what we've been talking about in this entire conversation, is how the citizen role, as imagined by the people who signed the Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787, were able to do at least elementary oversight on their government. Today, they can't do that anymore. It's written into the Constitution in Article 1, I can't remember the exact clause, that citizens of the United States will be given ultimately an accurate accounting of how their tax dollars were spent. That hasn't been true in the United States since the Manhattan Project of World War II to build atomic bombs. And still, 30% of the defense budget is black. Nobody in Congress gets to see it. You have to be a uniform military officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's $30 billion a year.
Right, right.
It's that kind of thing that ultimately has caused the public to become a spectator of Washington, rather than a group of people that are directly involved and that have tremendous interest and stake in what goes on.
You add Chalmers also to your list. You add that there has to be this environment where you almost have a cesspool of corruption, where you have these incestuous ties between corporate America and government, and that they're really one becomes one in the same.
Well, the military-industrial complex has today so corrupted the Congress that Congress has become the handmaiden. Congressmen, congresswomen have become the servants of the Pentagon. They'll do anything to produce a new military base in their district, to produce a new contract for one of their companies. I live in the 50th District of California. Our representative until just last year was Randy Duke Cunningham. who's now sitting in federal prison.
Luckily.
For 8 years yeah. for soliciting bribes from the military-industrial complex. I had written a piece of the Los Angeles Times well before the district attorney in San Diego started to go after him.
I'm familiar with
that. On saying that just on his filings with the Federal Election Commission, he was owned and paid for by the big defense contractors. The interesting thing to me is I got letters back from that that article saying, God, I wish you were my congressman. I could use a good job. You know, that's what we do in America. Geez. We make weapons. We make pretty good weapons, even if we don't make very good cars or a few other such things.
You know, one thing that it almost ties in with that last anecdote that you gave us, that there is this dynamic that exists that dooms empires, and it's an unwillingness to change. It's
an inability
to change. You have isolationism. You have this overstretched military government.
As a professor of international relations, I'd have to say we teach that no empire ever voluntarily gave up.
Yes, okay.
But there are a few examples. The British did after World War II. I think that we'd have to say Gorbachev was doing everything in his power in 1989
to save himself, right? Yeah.
To open friendly relations with France and Germany, and to get rid of those crummy satellites that Stalin had built in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But he was stopped cold by vested interests, huge vested interests, in the military as a way of life. That's what we mean by militarism.
That was the late Chalmers Johnson, author and historian, and one of the greatest minds of the 20th and the 21st centuries. Coming up, author Frank Schaefer is going to be here to explain how the evangelical right has taken America hostage. I'm Mike Papantonio. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire.
'Cause you're a sky, 'cause you're a sky full of stars. I want to die in your arms.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you're listening to the best of Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Mike Papantonio. During the Bush years, the religious right was front and center with the Republican Party, helping to dictate policy and guide the party. But today, they're operating behind the scenes, pulling the strings for major Republican politicians and fringe members of the Tea Party. Join me now to explain how the religious right is still holding the Republican Party hostage is Frank Schaefer. Frank, the holy war continues. It's amazing to me that corporate media just doesn't understand that this really isn't a political war that's taken place between the really frenzied evangelical end-of-timers and the rest of the secular world. But it's a holy war, I mean, in the truest sense, isn't it?
Yeah, and this holy war goes way back. It's Tea Party, it's right-wing, but it also is rooted back into stalwart figures like Billy Graham, who, for instance, recently threw Christianity Today magazines claiming Jesus is coming back any time. His son Franklin pushes that message as a right-wing kind of spur to get people to vote Republican and give money to Tea Party causes. And, you know, it's a circle. It isn't one element. It's just the entire evangelical juggernaut keeps moving forward in these kind of delusional apocalyptic fantasies. And that's, you know, that's part of the deal that the secular media, the large media, just doesn't seem to want to touch. I guess it embarrasses them, or they wished it would go away.
Well, it's almost like spiritual retribution is going to take place, or bad karma is going to take place. So they ignore the most important element of what's really happening here. I mean, you know, to lay this out, you know, I've followed your writing for so long, and so let me try to lay out some of the ideas that I've gleaned covering Frank Schaefer for a lot of years. And that is, first of all, the divide takes – it's an historic divide that
right.
really began in the late 19th century.
Right.
Pick it up from there and tell us how that divide still is alive and well today.
Well, you know, you go back to the 19th century, you've got a big argument between liberals, liberal theologians, and fundamentalists. The liberals saying, look, the Bible's not all literally true. There are great moral teachings in it, but not everything that they said happened, happened. It's a collection of mythical texts. Then the fundamentalists say, no, every word is true. And, of course, they're a little embarrassed by this because that includes stoning people who lose their virginity in the gate of their father's house and so on and so forth. And they paper it all over saying, well, since Jesus came back, we've kind of moderated some of those opinions, but they pretty much stick to it. So, you know, in their view, Noah's lining the ark with, I don't know what kind of litter box he'd have to have on there, but he had dinosaurs and all the rest of it, as far as they're concerned, because it's a young earth and all the rest. Ridiculous thing.
600 years. Well, let me back up just a second. First of all, we saw it was almost, there was an effort in the 19th century to adjust to the real world. We saw it happen with Judaism as well.
Right.
You know, you have Judaism that says, look, we can't be so extreme in the literal nature of our beliefs that we don't have broad appeal.
Yeah.
So the 19th century, you started developing that same kind of divide where the
right.
people with a brain started saying, look, we want to attract people to Christianity. Therefore, we have to abandon the idea that Noah showed up with dinosaurs.
Some did, but others just did a cheap thing that is very American, and that is they kept their beliefs, but they rebranded them, and they called fundamentalism evangelicalism. They gave it a nicer spin. They kind of separated it off from the racism that had gone with the fundamentalist movement often in the South. And folks like Billy Graham, Christianity Day magazine, and my own father, Francis Schaeffer, who became one of the founders of the religious right, emerged to say, no, you know, we're not fundamentalists, although they didn't change the theology. We are evangelicals, and that's a nicer, kinder, gentler version of the same thing, but it's still exclusionary. And God loves you, but by the way, if you don't accept Jesus, he's going to burn you in hell forever. Now,
okay,
they didn't
so what,
put it that way, but right, that never changed.
Right. What happened in the division from what, some of the material I've read from you is that it's almost like the real extreme evangelicals that, they, as you point out, they renamed themselves evangelicals
right.
because they, from standpoint is they were embarrassed by what was happening. They wanted to disguise it, but nevertheless, they came away pouting. They came away
right.
embattled in this adversarial kind of position
that's
with
right.
the rest of the world.
Yeah, and of course that spilled over into the religious right that we were part of in the 70s and 80s with the anti-abortion movement, and then that, of course, is the formative stage that then eventually full speed ahead to Ted Cruz today. And you've got the Tea Party movement saying, listen, we don't care what it does to the world economy or if it costs America $24 billion. We're shutting down the government because we are bitter against anybody who's not part of us. And that's the saved and lost paradigm. That's the black and white paradigm. You're either, you know, right with Jesus or you're going to hell. And you apply that paradigm to American politics, and you've got the kind of delusional stuff that I've been writing about in my new book, And God Said Billy.
Very good stuff, by the way.
Thank you. Which is really an examination of this delusional quality of American religion, which essentially has not only cut itself off from fact-based history and politics, but now, fast forward to our movement with Fox News and all the rest, has an entirely alternative system of approved communication that doesn't even relate to fact. But
okay,
let me ask you about that.
Okay, we come out of the shutdown war. Okay, and everybody
right.
says, okay, who are these people?
Right.
All right. Well, the who are these people ends with the analysis of a purely secular analysis. It is, well, there are people who simply don't want to pay more taxes. There are people, they're anti-government people.
Right.
But there's more to that, and that's what I read in what you're saying. You're saying
yeah.
that if we really distill what is this new movement about, just like they're recalcitrant about evolution, they're recalcitrant about global warming, they're recalcitrant about gay rights, they're also recalcitrant about increasing the debt limit.
Right.
And it's the same group, this literal
group.
Bible group that we're talking about. Is that did
yeah,
I get
I
that
mean,
right?
Remember where I came out of? You know, we had a lot to do with Republican leaders back in the 70s and 80s, people like Jack Kemp, Bob Dole. You could disagree on policy, but they weren't living in la-la land. Now what we have is essentially the village idiots not only controlling the Tea Party, but through the Tea Party and gerrymandering the Republican Party. And you got to understand, these aren't outsiders knocking on the door demanding attention for their little pet peeve. They are senators, they are congressmen, and they've got a lock on the direction of our other major political party. This is serious stuff. And they abide in an alternative universe, and where the media doesn't get it, and why I wrote And God Said Billy is this, and that is, unless you understand that America's problems are not politically rooted, they are rooted in delusional religion and extremism, then you don't get it. I'll give you a parallel. I'm not saying there's an analogy, but I think it's apt. and that is there's no point discussing why people put on suicide vests and blow up mosques if you're never going to mention radical Islam. If you don't mention radical fundamentalist right-wing, white, predominantly Southern, often bigoted, racist Christianity, then you're not going to have a clue as to why Ted Cruz's father is a crazy man, why Ted Cruz has inherited that extremist right-wing mantle, and why the religious delusion that has taken the Tea Party over the edge is threatening to take so much of our country's politics down, or why there's gridlock. And as I say, you know, it's not a question of a parallel between, oh, well, there's extreme on the left and extreme on the right. They're all kind
of
the
same. Yeah, isn't that moral equivalent? That moral equivalence has gotten so ridiculous with the media, where they're saying,
right,
well, gee, both sides don't do the bonehead things that we see coming
right
from the right-wing crazy evangelicals. I mean, there's no other way to describe it except dull brain ignorance.
There is, and I'll tell you what, it's worse than that, because it's willful ignorance. It's saying, look, we don't care what science says about global warming. We don't care what the International Monetary Fund predicts for America if we default. We don't care what the fossil record shows on evolution. We're going to circle the wagons. And as my character Billy in And God Said Billy did, come out of a homeschool background that feeds on the delusion and then lets it loose into the society through people like Fox News and the right-wing media. But the secular media, and this is where I fault people like the New York Times and the New Yorker and others, with a few exceptions of people who write about it once in a while, you could read reams of political coverage and never get to the fact that one thing binds 60, 70, even 80% of all these people together, their leaders, the Fox News watchers, and all these guys. It's radicalized, bitter, adversarial, evangelical Christianity.
And the bitterness that you're talking about comes out of their lost war in the late 19th century.
That's
when you
right
had when you had really correct thinkers say, look, we can't ignore science.
Right.
We can't simply stand there and say that Darwin was wrong when he has this empirical data to show it's true.
Right.
We can't ignore the fact that the sun comes up and goes down in a certain way every
right
day.
Right.
And but nevertheless, what is it? What is it, Frank? Now, again, let me preface the statement by telling you this. I was raised in the South around all of this.
Right.
But if you haven't been raised where your neighbors are, you know, Pentecostal, Southern Baptist,
right,
you know, really extreme, you don't get this. You don't even know it exists.
Right.
So what is it that allows these folks to put themselves in a posture where they can allow themselves to do that? Let's take a break and pick up with that when we
sure
come back. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Mike Papantonio. I have author Frank Schaefer with me, and we're talking about how the evangelical movement has hijacked American politics and how it's helping drive the GOP even further to the fringe. Frank, before the break, we were talking about how is it that a person can shut down their intellect so completely in the face of overwhelming information
right
and still say, no, this isn't really happening.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, neuroscience shows us we all do it in some ways. Look, I live next to the ocean in northern Massachusetts. The tides are getting higher every year. I'm not moving because this is where I live. It's a kind of a denial syndrome of the fact of global warming. I see it on my lawn. Different grass is growing there. Trees are dying. It's happening. I kind of, well, I'll just have to weather the storm. We all have that propensity psychologically to protect ourselves. But in the case of the evangelical delusion, what happens is there's a different kind of snapping. And that is that when you have taken with your mother's milk that the world is your enemy, that they are liars, that Jesus is the Son of God, and if someone disagrees with you, they're flying counter to all of reality, that God is going to punish them forever. It puts together a kind of a sense of we and they, black and white, saved and lost, which other parts of society rarely have. There is no middle ground with that point of view. You have to either be in or again it. There's not a middle ground. And, of course, for folks who stand it in their whole life, look, there are different kinds of religious leaders. There's people like Franklin Graham, who I sincerely believe does not believe a word of what he's saying.
Oh, no, he's
building a fundraising empire on
yes
the reputation of his daddy.
Yes.
Then there are others who, like Ted Cruz, are even scarier because they're entirely sincere and they've really drunk the Kool-Aid. That's the kind of religious delusion that I am unpacking, and I hope offering a solution to in this book of mine, And God Said Billy. And I can just say that when I wrote this book, working on it over the last 17 years of examining the religious right as I fled from it and survived from it, as I wrote this book, I kept thinking to myself, look, this is pretty far out. Nobody could be this crazy. Lo and behold, in the actual time frame it's released, the Tea Party, through their evangelical membership in Congress, those guys are all, by the way, white, right-wing evangelicals, mm-hmm. to the man.
And that's why we can expect more evangelical, self-inflicted chaos, as you put it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that level of delusion isn't going to go away. That is
let's add another element to it. Let's add this apocalyptic cult everybody talks that understands this issue. They understand the distinction of this apocalyptic cult. Houston Smith in wisdom traditions goes back. And if you take a look at what he does, he says, "What are the danger? Where's the danger in all this?" Mm. Well, with Christianity, obviously the danger is, and when we say the apocalypse is coming, end of time
right.
is coming, and by golly, we just there's nothing we can do about it.
Right.
Syria. We looked at Syria. If you really drill down on the numbers, who was it that said, sure, go ahead and invade Syria?
Absolutely. Who was it that said, let's go into Iraq? Who was it that said, let's bomb Iran into the Stone Age? Who was it that has basically focused, while China and Asia has become actually the most important global force we need to reckon
with? It's all about rebuilding the temple.
It's all about the Middle East. It's all about waiting for Jesus to come back. It's not an accident that George W. Bush was an evangelical who believed that protecting the Middle East for the kind of apocalyptic fantasy scenario in the book of Revelation and other parts of Scripture was part of his job. Again, you know, where was the New York Times series of editorial exposés of his own, George W. Bush's own evangelical Billy Graham fantasies? And yet, you know, here he says, I'm following Billy Graham, I'm saved and born again. You look at what Graham is saying right now in his new book being pushed for fundraising purposes by his son, who, by the way, spent thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars on a birthday party for his dad down there, where they had Donald Trump, Sarah Palin, everybody else showed up for the 95th birthday.
The juggernaut
rolls on, and no one says, look, you know, this is all very fun.
Is the New York Times afraid to say anything? Is the New Yorker afraid to say anything? Because it almost comes off as it's an attack on Christianity, possibly by people who are non-Christians, or
they may be Jewish, or
they may be Muslim, or they may be Buddhist.
Right.
And all of a sudden, my God, we can't say anything about Christianity, even though in our face we see how dangerous this is, and it doesn't need to be dangerous. You just need to, you know, everybody was waiting for Rick Warren to bring, and Rick Warren was just another one of them. I mean, he got by a little while.
Right.
You know, Obama has him show up in the inauguration as if Rick Warren is a different breed. He's not. But you do need a different breed, don't you?
Yeah, and the funny thing is actually there are so many millions of reasonable, just to put the shoe on the other foot for a minute here, reasonable, moderate religious people out there. They would be so relieved if some of the religious establishment, forget just the New York Times, you know, just people running outfits like Christianity Today magazine or the presidents of large Christian colleges like Wheaton College or others stood up and said, hey, listen, there's an alternative vision of these things. We've made a terrible mistake here. We're not all like that. Let's rethink our position, beginning there. Or if the large secular media said, look, we do believe in religious freedom. We believe in religious tolerance. This is not religious tolerance. This is tolerance of political extremism in the name of religion. It's an entirely different thing.
In about 30 seconds, Frank, why is it that they're so willing to buy into the Old Testament and just ignore the Beatitudes in Matthew and the Sermon on the Mount? What's that about?
Well, I think the Old Testament fits in with our primate, vengeful, tribal, ancestral village in our evolutionary cycle just so beautifully, doesn't it? You know, you exclude the other tribe and you bash their head in if they get in the way. It works great for people who want to circle the wagons. And then you combine a group of people afraid of the demographics. America's turning brown instead of white. There's a black man in the White House. All the rest of this, and you begin adding these factors. Fundamentalist Christianity has lost its allure. It's losing its new generation. These people are lashing out. They're afraid. And being afraid and lashing out, it's a temporary phenomenon. They're going to lose. Thank God. I believe that is the case.
I do, too.
The way down, we have to be aware. And I think for the good of individuals, we have to be aware of the kind of things that drive these folks for their own sakes, for our cousins, our friends, for the kid who's growing up fundamentalist now and who's gay and who's going to stand there on a bridge wondering if he should kill himself because they're telling him he's a dreadful sinner. We need to be honest about these things to help individuals, not just our politics and policy.
Yeah. Frank Schaefer, thank you. Great book, and God Said Billy. Everybody ought to go out and get this. Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Just ahead on Ring of Fire, James Meredith, the first African-American admitted to Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi in Jackson, will be joining us to talk about the 50th anniversary of the integration of Ole Miss. That's just ahead, so stay with us right here on Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. It's been 50 years since the University of Mississippi Ole Miss was forced to comply with federal integration laws. And since that day 50 years ago, the United States has made tremendous progress in racial equality. However, even with that progress, there are still too many segments of the population that are struggling to achieve equality. But the progress that we've made so far could not have been achieved if it weren't for the courageous efforts of heroic citizens who refused to be treated as second-class Americans. And I have one of the great figures of that age, my friend James Meredith, who was the African-American student who was admitted to Ole Miss. And I think originally, I know you said at one point you'd been inspired by President Kennedy's inaugural address. James Meredith was in the United States Air Force from 1951 to 1960. Then he attended Jackson State University for 2 years and then decided to enter the sacred citadel of Ole Miss, which had been a white enclave since its founding. The Brown versus Board Education case had been issued by the Supreme Court in 1954. And he was twice denied entrance, and then the U.S. Supreme Court declared that Ole Miss must admit him. Governor Ross Barnett, who had actually supported President Kennedy in his 1960 campaign, became his adversary in President Kennedy's and my father's efforts to get James Meredith admitted to the state. And there was a melee at that time that, in many people's view, was kind of the last great battle of the Civil War, with over 10,000 United States troops, with 500 U.S. Marshals, 160 of them were injured in the riot as rednecks came in from Yazoo and from Birmingham and from Selma and from Lowndes County and from as far away as California with squirrel guns and rocks and bricks and attacked the Lyceum building where the U.S. Marshals had gathered for a last stand. Two people were killed, but in the end, James Meredith, with the help of one of my father's closest friends, John Doerr, entered the university. And I think you've said in the past that you slept very well that night.
Right.
You actually were in a dorm behind the Lyceum building, and you went to sleep early while the riot was going on. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. That's correct.
Because you had done your job.
Absolutely. And that was to get the government of the United States to use the military force of this nation to enforce the rights and privileges of all citizens, including black citizens.
Well, talk about your relationship to the Kennedy Justice Department.
Well, I always considered the Justice Department the president's brother, your father, Robert Kennedy. And it was his decision. And that decision, I believe, was to extend the coverage of citizenship rights to everybody. And I think he understood that and carried it out for the first time. It's just that simple to me.
Now, the chief of the Civil Rights Division at that time was my father's friend, a former Yale law professor, Burke Marshall. And his other friend was a Republican whose name was John Doerr. And he found those two sitting in at the office on, I think it was on a Friday afternoon, and he said to them, I want you to go down to Mississippi and make sure that James Meredith gets into the university.
And, of course, that's exactly what I mean. You know things I don't know, but I certainly believe what you said is why things happen. The first time I ever actually talked to anybody was to your father, and that was years later when he was a senator from New York, and I was a student at Columbia Law School.
You met John Doerr when he was down in Mississippi with you, didn't you, and Burke Marshall?
Oh, yes. I particularly Burke Marshall, I have no doubt about his input. He is the reason that I first wrote to your father, the Attorney General. Actually, it was more to the Kennedy administration, but the letter went to him. And that was Burke Marshall that caused that to happen.
And how did that happen exactly? Did you call the Justice Department first?
Well, actually, there was a young lawyer who had just graduated from Harvard and came to Mississippi to practice. William Higgs, I believe, was his name. And he was really the one that brought Mr. Marshall into the picture. And he arranged for me and Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General Burke Marshall, to have a conversation, and Mr. Marshall asked me to send a letter outlining what I was planning to do. And I did that.
How well do you remember, were you conscious that there was a battle being fought that night and that there were thousands of people involved in it, including the U.S. military?
Frankly, I would have never been there if I had not known that.
Well, you knew that the military was coming, but that night my father...
No, it wasn't coming. They were already there. I saw them. I mean, not in Mississippi, but in Tennessee. I was staying at Militant Air Force Base, and I saw all the troops coming in. Actually, I saw them marching and, you know, getting themselves ready.
What was it like after that initial crisis passed? What was it like going to classes and going to lunch? And did you have a guard, a U.S. Marshal guard, during your entire time at Ole Miss?
Every single day.
And they ate lunch with you?
No, they didn't. The Marshals didn't. The only one that ever did was John Doerr.
Right. And was there acceptance? Was there a gradual acceptance of your presence on the campus?
It's 50 years later, and there still is no acceptance at the University of Mississippi.
Okay, well, explain that to us, because this is the 50th anniversary.
Well, I promised God I was not going to lie no more and I wasn't going to judge. So I'm going to let other people speak to that. My commitment to God is to the future. So he told me that, you know, he doesn't hold our sins against us. Only thing that matters when we decide to obey, we do that. So I'm gonna try to stick to that and deal with the things that we still need to do. I will say this about Mississippi. In terms of the poor people, and in terms of particular public education from the kindergarten through, or they don't have kindergarten in Mississippi, through the 12th grade, is much worse in 2012 than it was in 1962. And my God ain't happy about it.
We need to go to break. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire with James Meredith, the first African American admitted to Ole Miss.
Anybody here seen my old friend Bobby? Can you tell me where he's gone? I thought I saw him walking up over the hill. Abraham and Martin.
Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Right now, I'm talking with James Meredith, the very first African-American admitted to University of Mississippi, about the struggles he faced 50 years ago and his battle to receive the same rights as every other American college student. Can you talk about your relationship with Medgar Evers?
I really had no relationship. He, I think, and I think I'm right, I credit him with being the reason, not as why I was able to go to Ole Miss, but certainly the procedure that was followed, because I was highly arrogant in those days. And when he got on the telephone with me and Thurgood Marshall, after about 30 seconds, I hung the phone up and would have never talked to him again in life. But Mega Evers kept it going, and eventually Miss Attorney Constance Motley handled the case. So basically, I don't know, I can't say for sure what would have happened, but it would have been different if Medgar Evers hadn't done what he did.
Right, and Medgar Evers was killed shortly afterwards.
He was killed, yeah, in June of the next year.
Right, and he was shot in his driveway. His brother, Charles Evers, remained an enduring friend with my father. Medgar Evers was also a war veteran. And Charles Evers continues to operate a radio show in Jackson, I think.
I think you're right.
Tell me about the conditions on the Delta and the education system of Mississippi today compared to 1960.
Well, let's talk about the Delta first, because there are two people of high significance that were assassinated in 1968. Dr. Martin Luther King and Senator at the time, Robert Kennedy. Now, in 1966, I started a march through Mississippi, and on the second day I got shot. And Dr. King came and took up where I got shot. And as a result of that, he went through the Mississippi Delta. And for the first time in his life, he saw the real thing. And, of course, the next 2 years of his life, he spent with what he called trying to develop a poor people's campaign to show the world this tragedy. Now, the following year, I believe it was 1967, early 68, your father came to Mississippi, not with the intent of going to the Mississippi Delta, but he got talked into it. And what he saw, it just shocked his being. And I can't say the rest of his life he was trying to make this issue clear. But I do know for sure, when Dr. King died and your daddy died, nobody has even discussed this issue. And it is worse now than it was when Dr. King saw it and when your daddy saw it. And they've been silencing old James Meredith, telling people he's crazy. But I promise God, if I keep living after this election is over, I'm going to do my best to bring people to the reality of what is really going on, particularly in public education in Mississippi.
Now, when my father went to the Delta, as you said, it's a trip that changed his life. And he came back to our house that night, the night that he came back from the Delta, and he found us eating at the dinner table, and he said, today I was in a room in a house that is smaller than this room. There were three families living in it. And he told us, he wrote me a letter at that time, and I still have to this day, and he wrote me a letter the day that he got you, that the Justice Department got you into University of Mississippi, which I have on my wall this day. But he said that when you grow up, I want you to do something to help these people.
The tragedy is 44 years later, it is worse, not better. And it's so hidden, people don't even know it. Nobody's done anything about it since those two people were killed, and won't let the people who want to do something about it even make the world know about it. I'm sorry. I'm going to get off my soapbox and just try to answer your question.
No, that's okay. That's what I wanted to hear, if things had improved there, because that was something that deeply concerned my father. He found a baby in one of those huts that had flies crawling all over it. He talked about the lifelessness in the eyes of the people who lived there who'd just been beaten down by poverty.
And worse than that, our public education in the last 40 years, it's been all about money and money from the federal government, and a minimum of 40% up to 60% been siphoned off of the top, and the public education is more than a disaster. And nobody will let it even slip out what is really going on.
Well, can you just describe the education system in Mississippi, the public education system in Mississippi, compared to the 1960s?
When I graduated from high school 60 years ago, every black that got a high school diploma could go to some good college in America. Today, less than 1 out of 10 that get a high school diploma, and over half of them don't get one. The ones that do, less than 1 out of 10, can go to any college in America, including every black college in Mississippi, because they don't make a high enough college entrance test score. Everybody know it, and everybody's covering it up and hiding the lie. It is a tragedy. It is a worse tragedy than your daddy indicated in a letter he wrote to you. And nobody has dealt with that. That's not completely true. You know, after he was assassinated, they passed the 1968 so-called Civil Rights Bill. But then that ended it for everybody important. That ended it. And now it's almost like Brazil. In Brazil, they hide the poor behind an 80-foot-high wall so the people can't see them. Now, is the same thing going on in America today? The people don't see the reality of the poverty, and particularly the school situation. And it ain't just hurting the poor black. It's going to destroy America if we don't hurry up and take up what Dr. King died trying to do and what your daddy has said to you and probably others. Need to be done. Nothing has been done since they left here.
What he found in the Delta were children with distended stomachs from malnutrition. Their skin and hair was red rather than black, again from malnutrition, and they were undersized.
It ain't just children. I know you've been reading that Mississippi has the most obesity problem, the most heart problem. The thousands of kids in Mississippi can't go to school because there's no truancy, nobody checking who don't go to school. All of the effort is put on making sure everybody's in the right school. And you know what happens when the families all break up. You have children that aunts have agreed to try to help. They can't get them in school because they don't have the paperwork and don't have the money to pay a lawyer to get it. And don't nobody know nothing that ought to know everything.
Well, James, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And on this 50th anniversary of your entrance to the University of Mississippi, I saw you last year at Ole Miss, and I saw Charles Evers with you. And I hope that I get a chance to come down there and see you again soon.
Thank you, and I hope that the people who can at least know what's going on will take another look like your dad and you did 44 years ago.
James Meredith is a civil rights leader, writer, and political advisor.
Thanks for joining us this week on Ring of Fire. And if you want to keep up with Ring of Fire throughout the week, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just follow the links on our blog at ringoffireradio.com. And while you're there, you can help support the show by subscribing to our podcast or by sponsoring an hour of Ring of Fire. Your support helps keep us on the air. Scott Milliken is our executive producer. Farron Cousins is producer. Damian Hendricks is our video editor, and Brendan DeMille is researcher. Join us, Sam Cedar, Bobby Kennedy, and Mike Papantonio, every weekend on Ring of Fire.
Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I will try to fix you.